Unlock exclusive content and access to our podcast while supporting our show. How is that possible? Become a Narratives of Purpose patron at patreon.com/NOP podcast. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to Narratives of Purpose. You are now tuned into a new episode showcasing unique stories of changemakers, stories of people who are contributing to make a difference in society. This show was created to amplify social impact by sharing individual journeys of ordinary people who I believe are making extraordinary impact within their communities and around the world. My name is Claire Marie Gande. I am your host on this podcast. If you want to be inspired to take action, then look no further. You are in the right place. Get comfortable and listen to my conversations. Today's episode is the second of our three-part episode from the short series Exploring Sustainable Food Systems. I will take you on a journey of reviving ancient grains. We will also discuss the status of funding regenerative agriculture. My guests today are based in the United States, but they all have a connection to the African continent, particularly one of them, who was born and raised in Senegal, Chef Pierre Thiam.
And I'm traveling in the South and I see that grain again. And then, you know, when you get to the South, they serve you that grain to honor you. And I'm wondering, wow, this flavor is coming back from childhood and I don't remember seeing it in Dakar. Why is that? That was the question I'm asking myself. It's such a wonderful grain, so delicate. And now I'm doing more research on this grain, turning out this is a grain that's resilient, that's believed to be the oldest cultivated grain in Africa. I'm like, wow, why is this grain, I mean, just limited to the rural area? Why isn't it a world-class crop?
Chef Thiam's company, Yolele, advocates for smallholder farmers in the Sahel region by opening new markets for crops grown in Africa, such as fonio, West Africa's oldest grain.
I'm a mom of three children, and my kids have food allergies, as do I. So that's always been part of my curiosity and motivation, too, is to figure out, like, A, you know, when you do suffer from food allergies, what can you eat? Because it does make it rather restricted. And then B, more importantly, like, what's causing this epidemic of allergies? Like, why is it that in the modern era, we're suddenly rejecting the basic foundational foods that, you know, humanity built civilization around? Like, to me, that is a distress signal that something's foundationally wrong with our food system.
That is Joni Kendall-Moore, CEO and founder of Snacktivist. Her company partners with American farmers who use climate-smart grains that support regenerative agriculture, all the while radically impacting nutrition with allergy-friendly ingredients. To talk about mobilizing capital for regenerative food and agricultural projects, I will also welcome on this episode Sarah Day-Levesque, managing partner at Regenerative Food Systems Investment.
I was working with this group of farmers. They called themselves biological, organic, beyond organic, all different kinds of farmers. But their premise was the same, a healthier food system for both humans and for the environment. I was looking at the capital that was flowing into these farmers, and it was pretty much non-existent. And I had spent 10 years prior working with all this investment capital flowing into the agribusiness space and the industrial ag space. And that's where I was like, light bulb, like, we need to shine a light on the opportunity to invest in a regenerative food system and in farmers who want to do things differently.
For this episode, and ultimately for our sustainable food series to reach more people, I invite you to take a moment and share your feedback by giving us a review on Apple Podcasts or directly on our website at narratives-of-purpose.podcastpage.io. Then simply click on the review page. This will help other listeners find our show and further amplify the stories of changemakers we bring on Narratives of Purpose. In this second part of my Exploring Sustainable Food Systems on the podcast, I was fortunate to speak with truly amazing people whose remarkable work to revive ancient grains I had been following from afar. Let's begin the journey in Senegal with Chef Pierre Thiam. Chef Thiam had not planned to build a career related to food or hospitality. He told me that he was just adapting and adjusting to the situation he faced back then as a student. So, long story short, he was on his way from Dakar to Ohio for his studies when he stopped over in New York City for a while. But then he got robbed a few days after arriving. His return ticket to Senegal was the only thing he had left. And before flying back, he took a job in a restaurant as a busboy to make a little bit of money before he went back home. And that's how it all started.
I took the job because it was a job that required no particular skills. It was just taking empty plates back to the kitchen or filling up glasses of water for the customers and stuff. But that's really where it all began for me. You know, I got into that job, the routine of taking the plates back and learning something that I never thought I could learn. You know, in that kitchen, there was only guys in the kitchen. And I'm from Senegal, where it's a gender-based activity. The cooking is like the women, the secret of the women. And I'm, you know, growing up in Senegal, you're fascinated by the cuisine, regardless of your gender, because food is just such a big part of the culture. You know, we take the time to eat together. At noon, the whole country stops and everyone goes home for lunch. And lunch is always elaborate meals that take hours of preparation. Mom goes to the market every single day and gets you the fresh thing, cooks from scratch. The food is sophisticated. And there was all these other influences that we have in Senegal because of the positioning. It has become a hub for many years, you know, since colonial times. So we have all those other food cultures that have been coming. And I grew up in that environment, you know, with like the neighboring countries. We have street food from Benin and Togo and Cote d'Ivoire. We have, obviously, the French presence. We have the Vietnamese community. We have a strong Lebanese community. So all of that is part of, you know, my upbringing. And so I'm like, you know, even though I wasn't cooking, I'm fascinated by food. So I'm like, now men are allowed in the kitchen. So this is how I'm here now. And I, these guys become my first friends, my first comrades, because they see me looking at them spending more time than any busboy would spend in the kitchen. And the chef became a friend of mine for two reasons. He liked to practice his French. He had studied a little bit in France, and I was his opportunity to practice it. So he offered me to come in the kitchen and spend time. And he's like, I was a young kid. He's like, I could see in you, me, myself, you know, when I was studying in cooking. And, you know, if you are interested in learning a skill, you know, busboy, there's no future in it. You can start from the bottom up like I did. And from there, you know, I got the skills now. I left that restaurant a few years later. I went to work in an Italian restaurant to get another set of skills. Went to work in a French bistro in Soho. And eventually, I got promoted to chef de cuisine at another Soho restaurant. And I'm like, now really trying to see what's the next step. And the next step for me was to go back to my tradition. I was always missing that food culture from West Africa. And I was like also wanted to belong in this new country. And belong for me was to belong with my whole self, with what I have to contribute. And New York City wouldn't be really the real food capital of the world if the cuisines of my culture are not present. So that was really all of that thinking that was coming. And gradually, as I was chef de cuisine in that restaurant, I was also offering food for memory to my staff, you know, for staff meal. When we do family meal, I would just think about the dishes that my mom and my grandma, the things that we eat in Senegal, and I would just present it to staff meal. And staff meal was like, that was all new flavors for them. And they were like, wow, this could be introduced to the restaurant. Why don't we serve it as specials? And, you know, and all those reactions confirmed to me that this is a mission that I want to take now, really want to now really find inspiration from that cuisine.
After opening his first restaurant in Brooklyn in the early 2000s, which served African-inspired bistro cuisine, Chef Thiam got a cookbook deal that took him on another trajectory, as he said. A trajectory of creating an African food brand company.
As I'm writing the first cookbook, I'm thinking of substitutions for ingredients as I'm writing the recipes, because some ingredients are not accessible to the market here in the US. So I'm like, now the next step is to figure out how to make those ingredients accessible so that my audience, my readers, could actually prepare those dishes the same way my mom would prepare them. That's when this idea of creating a company that would be an African food brand that would have products in supermarkets around the world came to be. And as I'm thinking about the products, I'm also thinking about products that are not only back home supporting the small farming communities, you know, giving back in a sense, because all I was doing was inspired by that tradition. So it was, I owed my career to them. So it was one way to give back, but also to contribute as a model of development and selecting products that are also impactful, you know, in a positive way to the environment, you know, products that are resilient, products that are drought resistant. And the first one that came to mind, the first one was an ancient grain called Fonio. As I was growing up in Dakar, I wouldn't even have access to, only when I would go to the south to visit my grandparents during the summer vacation, I would have that grain. So as I'm doing research, I'm working on my second cookbook now, and I'm doing research, I'm traveling in rural Africa, because I wanted the book to be about where that food is coming from. Who are the producers? Who are the farmers? Who is growing the food? Who are the fishermen? And their story, their challenges. And I'm doing that, and I'm traveling in the south, and I see that grain again. And they, you know, when you get to the south, they serve you that grain to honor you. And I'm wondering, wow, this flavor is coming back from childhood, and I don't remember seeing it in Dakar. Why is that? That was the question I'm asking myself. It's such a wonderful grain, so delicate. And now doing more research on this grain, turning out this is a grain that's resilient, that's believed to be the oldest cultivated grain in Africa. I'm like, wow, why is this grain, I mean, just limited to the rural area? Why isn't it a world-class crop? It's delicious. And then you do more research and it turns out this grain is also a nutrition powerhouse. It's like it's gluten-free, it's protein dense, it has so much going for it. And it cooks in 5 minutes, and it's like, you know, so worth it. Anyway, it's amazing. It's mind-boggling that the grain's been ignored. It's like considered a lost crop, that they have a term for these grains. It's like there are crops in Africa that are considered lost crops or orphan crops. And I'm like, you know, very naive thinking, okay, I'm going to turn this grain into a world-class crop. And gradually, until today, we are in all the Whole Foods in America and all the supermarkets like Sprouts and Target. And we have a strong online presence. And we added all the products to now from Fonio.
It's an amazing story because from what I hear from the beginning, it was really like an unplanned opportunity. But then you were able to step by step gradually by learning on the job to really own it and make it yours. So you spoke about the grain. So that the brand is Yolele, right? And you also have a restaurant chain called Teranga. So tell me a bit about, you know, how do you build this between the restaurant and having also this brand that is bringing this super grain further away from the Sahel region?
Before Yolele, I had restaurants. I had two restaurants that were sit-down restaurants, you know, like the classic COVID, serving the cuisine, you know, inspired by my tradition. But it was a sit-down restaurant. And then Yolele came and I started to have the products in supermarkets. And for me, because the products that I had were new products, you know, like even though it's ancient grains, no one knew them. No one knew what Fonio was. No one knew what West African cuisine was. So it was an education. And education could be in different ways. You know, it could be through my books. You know, my books were dedicated to that. I even had dedicated my last book to the Fonio itself, the journey of Fonio, called the Fonio cookbook. So that was part of the plan on educating. And all that came, obviously, in steps, you know. And then I also started to think, as Fonio is taking off, I'm thinking about the others who are still intimidated because, you know, it's African food. People don't know what it is, you know, and the average people are like, you know, because, you know, you can't blame them. They've been brainwashed for so many years, thinking Africa is, you know, the continent of scarcity. Africa is the continent of famine. So you can connect food and abundance with all of that. So, you know, not to mention the history between Africa and America, you know, and all the crimes and the extraction and the all of that. So that affects, you know, the opinion. And so now I'm thinking the restaurants could be designed in a way that those also who have never tasted, they could come to the restaurant and taste what Fonio tastes like, a place like what West African cuisine tastes like, African-inspired cuisine, all those ingredients. And the restaurant to allow those people to enter it without even being stopped at the door when they see African food and stuff. I wanted to design the restaurant in a way that's like really convenient to that audience. So that's why Teranga came to me. Teranga is a fast casual concept. It's a fast casual concept that really fits in the New Yorker's lifestyle. As you enter the restaurant, you can enter and get your food ready within minutes and eat it. And you can also enter and design your own board. So you come and you see like a board that gives you all the different servings. Like you have the grains, you have the meats, you have the vegetables, you have the sauces, and you make your own thing. So they feel like they have an agency in what's coming into their plate. They're not coming and see the dish that's already flowed through for them and they're like, oh, I don't know what this is, I don't know, you know. They can be careful approaching it, careful, I'm going to taste this, I'm going to taste that, like, I'm going to come. And that worked, you know, that really was the way people discovered the cuisine. It's two different ventures, you know, the food distribution, the food products is one venture, Yolele, and Teranga is another one. The Teranga uses products from Yolele in the menu. They serve each other.
And to that point, actually, I wanted to ask you, have you been able to measure to some extent the impact of what you've done? Tell me a bit about how do you quantify or how do you explain the impact of your work so far?
Well, in many ways, really, and it's quite current now that we have chefs from the diaspora, you know, from African diaspora, young cooks, whatever, from anywhere who reach out and can connect with what we're doing and want to also find inspiration in their cuisine to that tradition, because West African traditional cuisine has inspired their cuisine growing up, you know, but they haven't seen it when they went to cooking school, because cooking school is giving them the so-called classics, which is like French and stuff, right? So they want to reconnect it. They realize how powerful it is, because food is powerful. Food is culture, and really that gives them a sense of purpose for them to find inspiration, to look for inspiration there. On the continent now, which was to me the ultimate beneficiaries, were the small farmers. I knew that there's going to be a point where we would have to put the focus on them. But before that, we would have to first open the market. And to open the market, because they knew how to grow it, they know they've been doing it forever, but they don't have access to market. So it was the first step for me. It was like, I have to make it desirable. I have to make it, you know, sexy. Once we create the demand, I have to make sure that the supply is following the demand. And that was where we had to figure out how to do it with a network of farmers. In the beginning, we identified farmers that were doing a better processing and just connected them with the market by taking their production and shipping it through containers to the US. As it was growing, we kept expanding the network of farmers, but it was definitely not going to be sufficient where the way we were going. We had to keep thinking ahead of time, because what we wanted to do, we wanted to not only bring these African products, but we really wanted to bring it the best quality possible. And at all the stages of our operation, we try to partner or collaborate with the best possible in the branding. For instance, when we were branding, we went to a company called Pentagram, who are considered the number one boutique design company in the world. And we went there and we really told them the story and convinced them to come on board with us. That really made the difference. And our packaging was so good that, you know, it allows us to tell the story. It allows the product to move off the shelves because people just go and go directly to it. And the interesting part is when you grow fonio in the land, it restores the soil. It regenerates the land because it has deep roots that add nutrients to the soil. So it's really a miracle grain. You know, but those miracles, you have to make them happen. And that's really where that challenge was. So we designed the mill and we found partners who would be operating the mill in Mali, which is another big fonio country. So the structure in Mali is called Sustainable African Foods. And I explained why Sustainable African Foods, because we're not a fonio company. Fonio was just our Trojan horse to enter the market, but it really was about introducing African foods and being a platform, a brand for African foods itself. Fonio was the Trojan horse, but we intend to bring gradually other products. So Sustainable African Foods is the mill that will process not only fonio, but will also process other crops like millet and sorghum. And the reason for that is we really wanted the communities that grow them to not only see fonio as like a cash crop and stop growing the other things. So we wanted to see that the farmers keep that tradition of growing crops in rotation, keep the tradition and introduce us to those products that grow naturally there, that are resilient, that the world needs to know, that are unknown, you know, and that really once they know them, realize that there's so much properties and so much to gain, not to even mention the flavors that we will add to the global table. So that's that contribution that we thought rural Africa could bring. And in doing so, we're offering a model of development that is also, you know, harmonious with the environment and with the culture and without disrupting, bringing their own product, finding wealth in their own product.
Now, you will certainly agree with me when I say that Yolele is a thriving company, a thriving social enterprise even. So I asked Chef Tiam about his vision of the future and also for his brand, the potential for market expansion in and outside of Africa. My thinking was that opportunities were greater outside of the continent. But have a listen to what he told me.
The potential is enormous. And to me, the challenge was to unlock that potential by really upgrading the standard of processing, right, so that it's accessible. Secondly, actually, I think you're wrong when you say there's a bigger opportunity in Europe. Actually, in Africa itself, there's a bigger opportunity because it's a part of our culture. These products are part of our culture, but we didn't have access to it in the standards, actually, that we want. You know, if you go to supermarkets in Africa, you would see like at least 50%, sometimes 90% of the products are coming from the West, and they're branded this way. But if you go there and you see a product that's like properly done, properly packaged of sorghum that reminds you of that sorghum that your ancestry know, that will be easily something you would go towards. So that's the opportunity that we realize that we want to tap into. And that's why Yolele West Africa in Dakar is going to be going after the African market itself and starting to add those products. Obviously, the Europe and other markets, regions of the world, are opportunities that are also non-neglectable. And they've been knocking at our doors forever, for since the beginning, really, especially for, you know, they've been knocking at our doors. And now we like that with the millet being established, now we have the possibility to access those. So that's the next step. We are going to go after those regions of the world and Africa itself. But to answer your question, I see a future where Africa is the place where it's coming from. You know, the solutions are coming from there, and the solutions not for Africa only, but for the world. I think the future for our global food security is in those underutilized crops from Africa and the arable land of Africa.
Let's continue the ancient grain revival journey to Idaho with Johnny Kindwell Moore. I came across Johnny's work when I discovered the podcast that she hosts, which is called Regenerative by Design. She explores the ideas, the stories, and the personalities behind the regenerative food system movement. But Johnny is also a key player in this movement with her company Snacktivist. There is a quote on the Snacktivist website that I really like, which says, "It is what we put in our products, not what we leave out, that makes them special." And this is what Johnny explained to me about this quote.
You know, I feel like for decades we've had this focus on this binary narrative of it's good or it's bad, or it's black or it's white, or, you know, it's free from or it's not. And I feel like we need to shift that paradigm to being like, what is it full of? Like, what are the value attributes, rather than just always focusing on what it lacks? And in the free from movement, like you look at gluten-free foods in the United States, so many of them are just totally devoid of nutrition. Like, they may be free from allergens, but they're certainly not healthy. And they're not using really healthy ingredients. And so many of these ancient grains that I'm really passionate about have incredible nutrition and wonderful nutrient profiles. And I just feel like it's time we started using them a lot more.
Johnny introduced herself as a farm kid from rural Oregon, saying that growing up in the countryside gave her a different way of looking at the world and where food comes from. On top of being a registered nurse, she also has a background in the hard sciences as an ethnobotanist who spent her life studying how people use plants for food and medicine. I wanted to know what led her to create Snacktivist, and this is where I found out about her connection to the African continent. Have a listen.
So in my 30s, I ended up getting my RN and spent a little over a decade as an ICU ER nurse and also doing some diabetic education. So again, working on, you know, medicine and health and everything, but really focused on diet as the foundation of health. Time and time again, it kept coming back to that being like the missing link, where we were doing all these heroic things that were fantastic and have a place, but often ignoring like the core foundation of what creates healthy people, which is the same thing that really creates a healthy planet and healthy environment as well. So that's what made me, you know, end up becoming a founder and CEO. I also have three kids, and my kids have food allergies, as do I. So, you know, that's always been part of my curiosity and motivation too, is to figure out like, A, you know, when you do suffer from food allergies, what can you eat? Like, because it does make it rather restricted. And then B, more importantly, like, what's causing this epidemic of allergies? Like, why is it that in the modern era, we're suddenly rejecting the basic foundational foods that, you know, humanity built civilization around? Like, to me, that is a distress signal that something's foundationally wrong with our food system, and that rather than normalizing allergies, I mean, we have to accommodate to them, of course, but we should not normalize it. We should take that as like a banner to like march under and say, what is wrong with our food system? Why are people having allergies in the first place? And how do we fix that? How do we push back on that epidemic of allergies?
Tell me a bit more about how it started. You know, what is the origin story? Obviously, you mentioned about allergies, your kids having allergy yourself, but also growing on the farm and having this special, I would say, lens on how food should be. So tell me about how you started Snacktivist Foods.
It really was kind of an interesting starting place, just because, you know, as a mom making foods for our family, like, I'm allergic to eggs and my son could not tolerate wheat and my daughter couldn't tolerate dairy products. So, you know, when you're looking at baking, you're looking at a lot of basic foods, like that eliminates a lot of them, like you can't eat them. And so I had gotten quite good at baking things that were vegan and were gluten-free, but while still using these whole grain, ancient grains, and I would bring them to work at the hospital and people would seriously like go, you should sell these are so good. And usually this kind of food is not good. And that's why we don't eat healthy, is because we have to have it tasting great. And so, you know, it just got me thinking, like, I've always kind of had an entrepreneurial spirit. And in fact, I was in a situation at my last hospital where I had a very intrapreneurial spirit. And I liked to identify problems at the hospital level that were either preventing access to care or delaying the time or costing extra money when it shouldn't. And I put together some projects at the hospital and I literally got in trouble for doing it, because they're like, you don't have permission to be thinking about how to solve these problems. Like, you're a nurse, just stay in your lane. You're not allowed to be thinking about system level stuff. I was like, okay. And I, you know, I was really motivated about food system activism because I was on a nonprofit board for local and regional food system work. And so that's really what led me to just go, you know what? I really don't have money. I don't really have time. I really don't have the know-how. But I was like, let's just start doing this. Like, let's put products in a bag. Like, I wanted to launch finished products from the beginning, like snacks or like ready to go. But we didn't have the money. Like, we didn't have any capitals. So that's really how Snacktivist was born, is I started putting our ancient grain flour blends into bags and selling them as baking mixes. So our first two products were a sorghum-based ancient grain pizza crust mix, and then a focaccia mix that was like a rosemary garlic bread. Again, focus on sorghum, millet, and teff as like the primary ingredient profile. And that's where it all began.
It's interesting. You just mentioned three grains there, sorghum, millet, and teff. And so I have cultural heritage in East Africa, and these are grains that I know from there, right? From traditional, like, you know, the porridge you would drink in the morning, or even like, you know, Ethiopian food, or Eritrean, they have the injera, which is made with teff. So when you started, you know, did you have collaborations or partnerships with some farmers, and how did that evolve with time?
I think it was through the lens of being an ethnobotanist and studying what other grains are central to the palates of people around the world is really why I got so excited about these crops and these foods. And of course, like, the cuisine of Eritrea and East Africa is very rich in these crops. And I did a lot of study into like how that all works. And that's what led me to going, oh my gosh, these are like really incredible grains. Like, they're very nutritious. They grow in very harsh environments that are high elevation and dry, like teff. And I started looking to see what the agronomic potential was domestically, because I didn't want to start out just importing these. I wanted to see if they were locally available. And the teff story is a really fun one, in that in Idaho, which is a very small state, we have under 2 million people in the entire state, even though we're a huge state. There's actually a family in the Boise area, which is south of us, that has a teff program where they have a processing and milling facility, and they work with farmers in Idaho and the region who are growing teff. And the story of that company, it's called Teffco or Mescal Teff. The dad spent time in East Africa in the 70s doing agricultural work there. And he discovered teff as a crop and was like, this would grow back home in Idaho. Like, this would be a fantastic crop. And so that's how it began. And they are still, like, 30, 40 years later, one of the leading teff producers domestically in the United States. And they provide a lot of the teff flour to domestic Somali, Eritrean, Ethiopian communities in the United States, and provide a lot of the teff flour to them for their products. We ended up starting to buy our teff flour from them, and we still do, and have a great partnership with them. And then with sorghum and millet, it is available as, like, a soft commodity. Like, you can buy those crops from any kind of a major grain brokers. But what we find in the United States is that most sorghum and proso millet is grown and fed to livestock application. So the development of sorghum flour and millet flour as, like, a human grade food is in its infancy. So we're working to develop that right now. And I work with farmers personally. And we also have a lot of deep relationships with universities where they're doing the research, they're doing the agronomy, they're doing the seed breeding and genetics. And so that way I'm not doing all that heavy lifting, but I'm working with them to try to kind of bring this movement together so that we can grow the market segment for sorghum and proso millet in human grade food. But we have to establish quality first, and that will help it to grow.
Joni just mentioned her experience working with universities. In fact, she is also the co-founder of the North American Millets Alliance. She told me that a lot of their work across the United States stems from the collaboration with universities, where they are trying to build a community, the science, the awareness, the agronomy, and the market drive for millets and millet-related crops, such as sorghum and teff.
Unless the movement comes to fruition, it will slow the understanding of the consumer about what our why is as an activist. So it's needed momentum that we need to leverage to grow as an activist. And UN Year of Millets is this year. So that's really driving some great narratives out there in the community to like increase that awareness about why millets are so important. You know, the UN takes a stance that, you know, given that we are in a warming pattern on the planet, and it does not give any indication of stopping anytime soon, that it's of urgency that we shift a lot of our, you know, major food staples towards crops that are literally designed for tolerance against heat and drought. And that's why they made UN Year of Millets this year, is because it's so important. And then also because a lot of these crops have a different relationship with soil and soil building than other, like, chemical intensive, highly hybridized crops that are out there in the market, where they are detrimental to soil development. What I hear from my farmers is that they love planting millet and sorghum and teff because it conditions the soil. They don't require a lot of fertilizers to perform, and then they don't need all the heavy irrigation. So they feel like it's restorative crops. It's crops that kind of allow their land to rest while still being productive.
And that's really an important point, because as we speak about shifting mindsets, mentalities, and so on, it's really also to understand what is the benefits, right? Not only for us in terms of health and nutrients, but also for the soil, right? And that's something really important to mention, that they actually regenerate the soil.
And soil health is so critical. I mean, we know that we're really up against a tight deadline, really, globally, where our soils are nearing, you know, complete depletion. And that's driven from many different activities, like from erosion to sterilization from use of heavy duty, chemical intensive ag inputs. But we know that if our global soil systems, get to a point where they're too exhausted, like we will not be able to produce food anymore. And that, you can only imagine what kind of a catastrophe that would create globally, even just with the war in Ukraine and everything, and like seeing the ripple effects of having our global food systems impacted, and weather patterns of the last year as well. Like, we see those ripple effects causing human suffering. And so, that, I think, to me is a real wake up call to be one step ahead and thinking about like, okay, as the world is changing and moving, how are we trying to stay one step ahead? And repairing the soil and regenerative is so instrumental in that, as well as breaking dependency on synthetic input farming systems.
Since you started, how have you measured the impact of your work? And what are people saying about your products?
People love our products. Like, we have a really long customer retention rate. Like, once we're discovered, like, our consumers tend to like rebuy their lifers, which is fantastic. And then we're always really interested in not only what like our home consumers think, but also our chef consumers, like at the food service level. What is the feedback from chefs and people who are, running kitchens, because that's a really different perspective. And if you can serve something that's really healthy, but good enough to serve in a food service setting, you're really winning. As far as our impact points that we're tracking right now, I mean, I will totally admit that we've been so busy just working to grow the brand that we've really been focusing on driving sales and exposure and momentum and adoption. And that has really consumed all of like our KPI focus. But we are always working on like the side where we're bringing on new farmers, we're building out farmer connected supply chains. We have an aggregated supply chain. So frequently we will have to pull from commodity because we can't run out, but then we don't have any farmer connected in stock. So we have to pull, but it's still a drought resistant crop. Like, it's still a crop that needs to be out there, whether it's farmer connected regenerative or not. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, we want to grow that awareness around those crops and the role that those crops play in food systems. So my goal is actually by the middle of the year, we're launching these QR codes on our packages, and it's through another company that I'm involved with called Food Vision, that is a tech-enabled platform that will allow transparency from field to plate and will also help to communicate impact data in an auditable, like authentic way, instead of just like greenwashing, like, oh, hey, here's what we're doing. It'll be like, oh, hey, look under the hood. Here's actually what we're doing, both good and bad. Like, here's kind of what we're up against. Because what people need to realize is that building regenerative supply chains from scratch is hard work. It's not something that you're like, oh, I'm going to be regenerative today. Well, the regenerative supply chain for our products does not exist. Like, we literally are building it piece by piece, brick by brick. And we want to invite consumers into that experience because, it's intentional, it's deliberate, and you have to really care a lot to make this work. We'll be having that QR code delivery. It's going live next month on our packaging, but it'll just be phase one, which is more kind of like introduction to the Stacktivist brand and learning about ancient grains and learning a little bit about our farmers. But then phase two, we'll start to connect them of like, oh, this TEF came from here, or, and so we're building out those layers as we go.
That's amazing. I really love it because especially since the pandemic, and people are being more and more conscious of how we eat, how we live, literally how we, conduct our daily lives. And the fact that, the product that you're buying, where it's coming from, who you're helping and how it was done. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. Transparency is really key at this point.
It is, because we're never going to be able to define regenerative, I don't think. And so that makes a really formidable challenge as far as getting certifications or validations on the market. And again, it's that binary mindset. It's either non-GMO project verified or it's suspicious. It's either organic or it's not. It's that binary mindset that doesn't work for regenerative, because generative is systems based. It's not black and white, And so to me personally, for someone who's spent a lot of time thinking this through of like, how can we do this? The only answer is transparency. It's the only way it can be done.
We have more coming up from our guests after the break. You will hear from Sarah DeLevesque, Managing Director of Regenerative Food Systems Investment.
Ultimately, our goal is to play a bigger role in connecting the solution builders, the farmers, the supply chain, the folks that are really trying to build solutions for the system with the right kind of capital, because that seems to be a gap that's missing.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after this short break.
Amplify Network is a community of impact-driven individuals. We create and curate the resources you need to upskill and grow expertise in sustainability. Our team supports startups and small companies to embed sustainability in business models and engage their own communities for faster and deeper change. Register to our Knowledge Hub on Sustainability at fructifynetwork.com.
Welcome back to Narratives of Purpose. This is the second of our three-part episode from the short series Exploring Sustainable Food Systems. Today, the focus is on reviving ancient grains and regeneration, but also mobilizing more capital for regenerative food and agricultural projects. Before the break, you heard from Chef Tiam's work with Yolele and Teranga on opening new markets for crops grown in Africa, such as fonio, West Africa's oldest grain. You also heard from Joni, the founder of Snacktivist, talking about driving a new grain economy. Now, let's come back to the conversation I had with Joni for a short moment. One last topic I wanted to get Joni's take on was meat analogs. You have certainly seen many of these products in stores or even restaurants. They are basically called plant-based meat, made mainly from soy or peas, at least the products I've seen here in Switzerland. Joni was quite candid about this, and she even mentioned the question of funding.
My call to action for people that are in the meat analog business is there is a need for alternatives, but make sure that they put what they're full of at the front of the conversation and that they're like, hey, we're getting these peas from farmers in Saskatchewan and, you know, they're doing regenerative, you know, practices, and like that needs to be forefront. And unfortunately, it's the free from mantra that is like leading the charge. And I just find that to be problematic. Over the last couple of years, growing what we're doing, time and time again, I'm talking to VCs and investors, and they're like, no, because we're investing just in meat analogs. And I'm like, okay, so you wouldn't invest in a naturally vegan product using regenerative ancient grains? They're like, nope, we're really focusing on meat analogs. And trillions, I mean, so much money went into building up that industry kind of artificially. And it actually starved and neglected an entire huge segment of the innovating natural product sector that were starved for capital because all the capital went into meat analogs for the last 3 years and literally starved out all these amazing other innovations that are of much more significance over the long term. So I actually personally kind of have an issue with that whole thing. It really makes me mad because, you know, here we were at the Plant-Based Food Association, like the big expo, global expo at the Javits Center in New York in 2021. And people, I mean, our booth was swamped because they're like, oh my gosh, we're so burnt out on fake meat. I'm so happy to just have like a waffle. It's like a normal food, you know? And then we'd be like, hey, well, why don't you invest? I mean, look at how crowded our booth is. It's more crowded than any other booth. Oh no, we just want meat analogs as an investment. So it's just chasing fads, and chasing fads never got humans anywhere. What I always say, I'm like, hey, look, we're still here and we're still growing, and a lot of your investments in plant-based meats are gone. I bet you wish you would have invested in us 3 years ago and not, you know, those other companies that tanked in the last 12 months. So, you know, that's where I'm like more of a CEO.
Since Joni just introduced the issue of capital and investment, it's the perfect transition to my third guest on this podcast, Sarah Day-Levesque. Listen to how Sarah's journey in the regenerative agriculture space began and how she started Regenerative Food Systems Investment, in short, RFSI.
I didn't grow up on a farm, which a lot of folks in the space did. I grew up in a town surrounded by farm and with a university that was very agricultural based. But I grew up like wanting to save the world. I remember being adamant that I was going to save the whales. That was the thing, the environmental thing when I was a kid. But that didn't really go anywhere. And it was my first year of college. I took a course, an environmental studies course. And there was a guest speaker in there who had just come back, returned from China. And he had been working in farming systems there. And he was showing all the pictures of what he did and how he was able to support the communities there and bring tools there. And that really resonated with me. And from that moment on, this was the first quarter of freshman year of college. From that moment on, I was like, okay, agriculture is the way that I can have an impact on the world. I took some courses in agronomy and immediately determined I was not tough enough to be a farmer. And a good thing, because it's really hard to get farmland these days if you're not already a farmer. But then I took some economics courses and I really liked this intersection of how economics and financial decisions and how that plays into the choices we, for both from a production side and also from a consumption side. And so from there, just been building this, how do we recreate a food system looking at the economics and the decisions that people have to make around that.
So was that the reason why you started RFSI, so Regenerative Food Systems Investment, to combine these two approaches and be closer to your wish to save the world?
It wasn't an immediate path to that, but looking back, I can see all the connections now. I spent some time in Kenya doing my graduate thesis work and working in small-scale farm milking systems. So it was raw milk producers, and how can we combine both food safety with the economics of they need to support their livelihoods with this. I loved that experience, but also realized I wouldn't be able to work abroad forever because I love being close to my family. And so I went to work for a consultancy that worked in more of the agribusiness space. And so what I would call now more of the extractive agribusiness space. I spent 10 years with them, and there I focused a lot on the investment space. So the capital that was coming into the food system. It wasn't until about 6 or 7 years ago that I had the opportunity to move on from that position and join a company that I felt was going to provide more impact in the direction that I wanted to go. And that was joining the parent company for a company called Acres USA, who teaches farming, ecological farming methods for farmers that are looking to take chemicals out of their systems and look for different economic paths forward as well. When I got to Acres, I was working with this group of farmers. They called themselves biological, organic, beyond organic, all different kinds of farmers. But their premise was the same, a healthier food system for both humans and for the environment. I was looking at the capital that was flowing into these farmers, and it was pretty much non-existent. And I had spent 10 years prior working with all this investment capital flowing into the agribusiness space and the industrial ag space. And that's where I was like, light bulb, like, we need to shine a light on the opportunity to invest in a regenerative food system and in farmers who want to do things differently. And that's where I started RFSI from. So it's a mouthful, Regenerative Food Systems Investment. But the idea was that not enough capital providers and funders knew about the opportunity to invest in different kinds of systems. Not enough of that investment was happening. So there wasn't any examples to follow suit. And so that's where RFSI started, with just a convening of getting the right people in the room to discuss it. And from there, we've been building out how we facilitate the system.
What type of activities or what initiatives do you have with RFSI that you are basically educating, or at least creating this awareness for the investors that there's more capital flowing into this type of agriculture?
We started with just a convening in 2019, 3 months before COVID hit. We had an in-person convening, which was convenient that we got that off at least, and just gathered folks together. And our point was not only to shine a light on the opportunity to fund this system and farmers in the system, but also to say, listen, there isn't a developed system yet for regeneration. We have farmers, but in order to make them successful, we also have to build a system around it. So what kind of systems need to be built? We need to have the support services for farmers. We need to have markets for the farmers, technical assistance. So all the way from the folks who are servicing the farmer to the CPG companies or the food companies that are going to sell their products. So the idea was, how do we bring all these stakeholders together and then show the investors that look at this entire system that can be funded? So we do annual convenings. We had our last one in October in Denver. It was a sellout crowd. It was awesome. And really just kind of showed us like how much this space is growing and how much investors and food system builders are looking to this space. We also do some online programming to keep it, when we're not in person, to keep people connected. We're launching an RFSI Europe event. It'll be virtual on January 25th. So super excited about that because there's so many cool things going on there. And then we have launched a free funder directory, which is trying to bring all of the funders of regeneration together in one spot so folks can come and say, who is funding the space? Who are the investment service providers in the space? And start understanding a little bit more about what that landscape looks like so that we can get more of our solution builders funded and getting aligned with the right capital. Ultimately, our goal is to play a bigger role in connecting the solution builders, the farmers, the supply chain, the folks that are really trying to build solutions for the system with the right kind of capital, because that seems to be a gap that's missing, which is there's capital curious about the space, and then there is all the solution builders that kind of need that funding to get their operations up and going. But not all capital is created equal. So how do we get those solution builders aligned with the right capital?
You will have, of course, noticed that my conversation with Sarah was recorded before the RFSI Europe event that took place 2 months ago in January. Along the lines of collaboration, I was wondering about the importance for RFSI to connect with other organizations outside of the United States. This is what Sarah said.
Outside of the U.S., we have partnered with some organizations in Australia. So Impact Ag Partners, who were at our first event in 2019, they've been very supportive of getting programming over to Australia as well. They have a very strong regenerative agricultural system there, and we need to grow the investor base there and the investors and funders that are maybe looking from the outside to fund that system and develop that system there. So we've done some programming with them and in that community for the last 2 years, which has been great. And then Europe, absolutely. There's such a big opportunity. I think it's been very interesting for me to see where Europe is in terms of regenerative agriculture, but and then post farm gate, like how the system is developing outside of that, which I think there's a lot of opportunity to continue to build.
Can you quantify or at least give us a sense of what has been the impact of your organization so far since you started, especially in the communities, right? You just mentioned that you've been focusing on the US, but you connect farmers, right? You connect the people, and this is all linked to the community. So have you seen any impact there on your work?
The quantifiable part is interesting because, you know, we work in a space where, especially with investors, where they want to quantify a lot of this stuff, certain types of investors at least. And so that's something I've been reflecting on since late last year when I was thinking we need to start quantifying what our impact is at RFSI, because we're so worried about helping other folks be able to fulfill their impact. So I don't have a lot of quantifiable data just in numbers of how many people we're reaching, but I do have qualitative data, which is what we're working on right now, which is the stories of, you know, our first year of our event. And we'll share some of these actually in the coming year. But the first year of our event, just the folks that we connected are then going forward and starting companies that serve this space at a greater capacity. So Providence Capital Group, if you look up them, they met and their company started at our, not started, but the connection started at our event. And they've really grown to work with lots of companies who are fundraising in the space and having a lot of big impact. Oftentimes we get requests like, I'm just starting to come into the industry. Where do I start? Where do I look? And so that's been a fun non-planned impact we have, which is how do we get folks connected with the right people so they can build their little spot in the regenerative space and the regenerative food system? And I just presented last week at an event where we presented to primarily farmers, small to middle scale farmers, and just showing them that there is an increasing amount of capital coming in, and you can now look beyond like your standard government grants to other types of capital. And so have an increasing number of them reaching out and saying, okay, who do I connect with? How do I get this? What do I need to do to get myself ready to talk to somebody about giving me money? So those are the places we're hoping to grow our impact in the coming years.
It goes without saying that as an entrepreneur and whenever you start any new venture, you will have challenges to overcome. I was curious to understand what were Sarah's major challenges with RFSI, even though she had been in the investment sector for a much longer time prior to joining the regenerative food space.
So first thing, when I came and started working in the regenerative space at Acres and with the community here, I will say, wow, the amount of collaboration that happens in this space versus in like the agribusiness space that I'd worked in before was stark. But you could just tell immediately that this was a community of people that and organizations that were like, let's work together to create change, which was awesome. I hadn't experienced that in the 10 years prior. So that was great. I think the hardest part, if I had to like choose one, and the hardest challenge is working in such a nascent area. Like when we started in 2019 and we really started planning in 2018, regenerative food systems, of course, rooted in indigenous values and systems, but really we're coming to the mainstream. And we were a little early, I think, talking about the capital conversation. And I think it's still, there's so much that's nascent about it right now. So the fact that there isn't a definition, the fact that you know, investors still can't look and see, like, here are all the examples of how you can have a successful funding of this system. All that new nascent stuff has been challenging in that we have to work around it and say, like, how do we keep this going? How do we continue to serve this space and help fill those gaps and kind of fill it as we wait for people to come in and come in and come in? So the more work we do, the better off we're going to be. It's just getting through that work to make sure those gaps of knowledge and understanding and data are filled.
So how do you see this space evolving? Because as you say, it's nascent, it's a new field. There's not enough experience so far to convince the investors or even some definitions to be aligned with everyone. Just give me your own perspective. How do you see this evolving? Are there any like things you see are going to change pretty soon? Or you see it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of effort, because it also requires changing of mindsets primarily?
That's a huge point right there, the changing of mindset. So it's interesting. I am pretty a cautious person, but I'm also tend to stay on the positive side. Like there's no way, like my feeling is there's no way this doesn't succeed. The challenge, of course, and you'll probably hear this throughout the series as you talk to folks, but is greenwashing and the folks that are, you know, coming in and are they being authentic in their efforts to support the building of a new food and agriculture system. But I truly believe that the more players we get involved, the better. We just, and I think that's coming. We see it. I mean, so many more corporate commitments this year at our event, so many more funders saying, how do I, am I might not be able to do it yet, but how do I allocate money to this space? We're just going to have to proceed with caution and care. I think there's going to be a certain amount of trust that has to happen in terms of there's new players coming in, let's let them in, but how are we going to kind of have the checks in place to make sure that that we stay authentic to what regenerative should actually be, which is actually being regenerative and not just in the agronomic and ecological aspects, but in the financial and community and livelihood aspects as well. Just one point on your mindset. The big thing for us, I think, is COVID has brought such a big shift in how we look at food systems. And so that attention is amazing. And I think that has taken us far in how much awareness there is. The next shift, I think, is looking at our other systems. So looking at how policy plays into this and how financial systems play into this. Because I've been talking a lot lately about how we were asking our farmers to have this mindset shift in how they produce. But we also need to say then, how does our supply chain make that shift as well? So they also have to do things differently. How does our policy make that mindset shift? And how does our financial system make that mindset shift so that it's not continually the farmers having to take on all of the risk in transition versus everybody else also accepting some of that risk?
To conclude this second episode that explored the multiple benefits of ancient grains and funding regenerative agriculture, let me share with you the individual recommendations from today's guests for each of us to also contribute to a more sustainable food system in our everyday lives. First up is Chef Pia Thiam, the co-founder of Yolele Foods and Teranga, a fast casual food chain in New York City.
Be an educated consumer. Be part of the solution. I mean, especially when it comes to food. I mean, you're going to put it in your system. Food is like everything. Food has the power of life and death. You know, it could give you health and life, or it can kill you. And it kills you sometimes radically, or it kills you slowly. And a lot of times we are killing ourselves slowly. When you look at all the chronic diseases that we have everywhere around the world, but especially in Africa. In Africa, the ones we have are imported. That's not part of our traditional diet. We're just importing them. It's all connected to our diet, all connected to the food. So educate yourself is one thing you can do. And again, you know, the choice you have every day when you, what you do, when you decide what you're going to eat is up to you. That is something that's completely up to you. So where you put your money for your own health, for the health of the planet, and for being a positive actor to the uplifting of rural farmers, small farmers, because, you know, they are the one who got it, who, you know, and now we need to just support them.
The next guest to share her recommendations is Johnny Kindwell-Moore, CEO and founder of Snacktivist.
I just think for people to stop before they put something in their mouth for just a second, and just to think about it, like, what are the effects of this? Like, is it good for me, but is it good for more, is it good for we Like, I think it's like, is it good for me? Is it good for we? Like, that is a huge perspective shift because, you know, more and more people are aware and reading labels and looking at the nutrition facts. And that's great. Like, that's step one. But I think we do need to just take on that additional layer of, you know, not only thinking about how it's affecting us, but like our own personal body, but how is it affecting the community? How is it affecting the planet? And once you start asking those questions and you just stop and think about it, a lot of the learning starts to come to you, right? It's like it just takes asking the question and suddenly a whole nother world emerges that you never saw or recognized was there. And that's where the path of like long-term food system sustainability and resilience will happen, is when people start asking the right questions.
Closing up our recommendations part is Sarah Day-Levesque, Managing Director at RFSI Regenerative Food Systems Investment.
Pay attention to what your purchases are, how you're consuming. It's hard to do. I feel bad asking consumers to take out one more thing and say, learn about it, but learn about where your food comes from, even just a little bit. That will go a long way in kind of understanding what your impact truly can be, because we do vote with our dollars. And then secondly, I'll throw another one in there, is if you have a chance to visit a farm to understand, do it. It's one, it's just an amazing experience, but I think it will bring folks closer to the experience of farmers and everything that they go through to produce food for us every day. I'm going to add a third one if anybody's interested in this, and it's not for everybody, but, you know, just grow something. Like, if you have a container to put it in, or a little tiny space to make a garden, like, that opens up a whole other world of, like, one, just mental health, because it's amazing, but also, again, brings you more in connection with, like, we actually have capabilities of growing food, and it's a rewarding experience.
So what about you? Are you familiar with any of these ancient grains? Is fonio, millet, sorghum, or even teff part of your staple foods? And have you ever considered investing in regenerative agriculture? We would love to hear from you. Share your experiences with us by connecting on our social handles. You'll find the links in the episode show notes. Join me again in 2 weeks for the third and last part of our short series exploring sustainable food systems. I will bring you closer to those who focus on building networks and building community around food production. You don't want to miss this final episode, because I will be joined by Imani Black, the founder of Minorities in Aquaculture, an organization that promotes a more diverse and inclusive aquaculture industry. My second guest will be Bastian Frisch, a leading member of Urban Agriculture Basel, a network that promotes projects in the Basel region committed to organic and holistic food cycles. Finally, I will also host Romain Oegerli and Johan Pelot, the co-founders of Alles Gut Gemüse Kebab, the first sustainable kebab restaurant in Geneva. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I appreciate you taking the time. Remember that you can share this episode with your network, with your friends and your family. As always, we would appreciate you rating our show with 5 stars on Spotify. Last but not least, we have set ourselves up to grow a thriving membership community that gives you exclusive content and access to our podcast. Please check our Patreon page and choose a membership level you feel comfortable donating for. All the details are available at patreon.com/NOP podcast. That's patreon.com/NOP podcast. We are grateful for your support. Until the next episode, take care of yourselves, stay well, eat well, and stay inspired. This podcast was edited and produced by Tom Evan Hughes at Rustic Studios. This episode was written, translated, edited, and hosted by me, Claire Morigande.